We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Monday, February 17th. It is President's Day. So congratulations to all of you who celebrate and are off work. But we are here at American Family Radio Network to bring you the latest news and headlines. And today we're going to talk about the latest in the culture wars, with this headline coming from toddstearns.com. It says the Army no more transgender recruits, also bans gender transition surgery. So the U.S. Army unleashed a series of breaking news alerts today. This was Friday, announcing they are ending a number of woke programs and policies. Transgender individuals will no longer be allowed to join the Army. The military posting a message on X, also announcing they will no longer perform or facilitate procedures associated with gender transition for service members. So let's welcome in Todd Starnes himself, who, of course, is also a Newsmax host. He has a wonderful podcast as well. So, Todd, it seems like in just the first month of the Trump administration 2.0, they're really going after a lot of these woke policies just to return America to common sense. But where are we at in terms of the overall culture wars? Because we also have to get buy-in, of course, from people who have previously bought into this whole transgender LGBTQ mafia nonsense.
Yeah. Good morning, Jenna. I'm excited about where we are right now, and it's really hard to keep up with all of the changes that are taking place. The president is acting very swiftly, and he is very surgical here in the early days of the administration. So it's an exciting thing to see, and we haven't really seen this in modern political history. And quite frankly, this may be from the entire history of our nation. I would say, though, that one of the areas that I am a bit concerned about would be the future of the Department of Education. Linda McMahon, who is the nominee to be Secretary of Education, actually said during her testimony that her goal was not to defund or dismantle the Department of Education, but to sort of rework it. To almost re-envision it in some form or fashion. And Jenna, I think that's a very disturbing and disappointing answer to that question, because President Trump is on the record as saying the Department of Education has to be dismantled. And the reason why that's important is that when you look at all the social change that's been happening in the country, it's all been coming from our nation's education system. So that's really the engine driving this change in the country. Now, granted, the Secretary of Education cannot physically dismantle and defund her own agency. That can't happen. That's the job of Congress. But I do think that we need to focus extremely hard on getting rid of the Department of Education and restoring those rights back to the states and the local communities.
Yeah, well said, Todd Starnes, and I agree with you. And that nomination and confirmation hearing kind of flew a little bit under the radar last week, just because it came off the heels of so much media surrounding RFK Jr., Tulsi Gabbard, and then, of course, Kash Patel, whose confirmation is still yet to be voted on. And yet, Linda McMahon, this was kind of a consolation prize, in all honesty, for her. The reports have suggested she really wanted where Brooke Rollins ultimately wound up, which was the Department of Agriculture. And so so this is sort of a fascinating exchange that you're describing here, because on one hand, President Trump has been very clear that he wants to dismantle the Department of Ed, but then his own nominee is saying something different. And this kind of re-envisioning really sounds more leftist. And the Deputy Secretary of Education, Penny Schwinn, who is from Tennessee, and for listeners who may not know, her whole nomination as well for deputy is very concerning because of a lot of the CRT-influenced curriculum promotion of DEI ideology. So is it your view, I mean, should we take away from this whole confirmation process of Linda McMahon that maybe she's going to be lobbying President Trump to do something ultimately different with the Department of Ed instead of putting herself out of a job?
Well, that is a possibility, and I certainly hope that's not the case. And here's the reason why. Because if we do not fix the Department of Education, if we do not dismantle and defund the Department of Education, all of this other stuff is for naught. Because ultimately, we're going to be right back to where we were before President Trump put his hand on the Bible. So that's why it's so vitally important for us to follow through. And I was on the record, I had a new book that came out in March called Twilight's Last Gleaming, Can America Be Saved? And in that book, I said, it doesn't matter what the president changes, talking about Trump. What matters is getting rid of the Department of Education. We've got to do that, or else nothing else is really going to matter, at least long term.
Yeah, and we've talked a lot on this program as well, Todd Starnes, about enduring wins and how even though, you know, Trump is just blowing up the news cycles in terms of executive orders, and he's doing so much, ultimately that can be undone by a future administration, or it won't be as long lasting if we don't make cultural changes and impacts, and we also don't codify some of these important policies through Congress, and then ultimately do some of those bigger things like dismantling the Department of Ed. And of course, the left is screaming, oh, well, you know, what about the kids? And, you know, they have all of these kind of, you know, shrill sounding talking points. But ultimately, that would just go to the states where it belongs. I mean, this is the same conversation about the overbloated federal bureaucracy that conservatives have had for, you know, 40 and 50 years. And so to return the power back to the states is ultimately in keeping with the founders' vision for a federalist system. And so how should conservatives respond to some of those attacks from the left against dismantling the Department of Ed?
Well, I think we should realize that before the Carter administration, we did not have a federal Department of Education. There is a history there within our own country. But I also think that we need to be calling our elected leaders. We need to be picking up the phone and telling them that we do expect for them to follow through with President Trump's demand. I mean, this is something that the president said he wanted to see happen. And I think we need, you know, we owe it to the president to get this across the finish line. And this is going to be a ferocious fight. And that may be one of the reasons why. I mean, the unions running the teachers, the NEA, for example, very, very powerful and very dangerous and quite frankly, militant, if I might be so bold as to use that word.
Yeah, and I think that this is exactly why education and higher education as well has been a huge focus for some of the right to look at what we're actually teaching our children, because ultimately, if we're still indoctrinating them with these kind of woke DEI policies that and worldviews that the left has put into and embedded in so much of this curriculum, then we're still raising the next generation not to view America and policy and government and civics and even each other with a correct and biblical, truthful worldview lens, but through the ideology of the left. And there's another headline that kind of goes hand in hand with this from your website, Todd Starnes. Democrats demand reparations, call Trump a white supremacist. Meanwhile, you know, you have Jasmine Crockett and others kind of going off on these rants. I mean, they just try to invoke racism and all of these isms wherever they can. And And nobody, I think, who is looking at reality correctly and is coming back to a view of common sense is buying this. But at the same time, they're still pushing out this type of messaging. I mean, is this really, do they think this is really going to be successful for them in the overall strategy of the culture?
Well, yes, which is so strange, because you would think that, you know, this is the sort of language that actually cost the Democrats the election. And I think especially, you know, you've got a group of and a very large demographic of white young men who have really been put upon, I mean, for well over a decade now. And I think that's where the pushback happened. You know, when you look at the demographics who went out and voted in the presidential election, young white males, that was a disenfranchised group. And a lot of the reason why is because of this sort of this rhetoric, this call for reparations. And it was Ayanna Pressley, the congresswoman from Massachusetts, and she said that we are living in an age of anti-blackness on steroids, which is ironic seeing how, if you believe the media, the most powerful man in the nation is, in fact, an African-American. That would be Elon Musk, who is from South Africa. But again, this idea that we are oppressed, I have to imagine that would come as a surprise to folks like Tyler Perry or Oprah or, you know, the NFL or the entire Super Bowl halftime show, which did not include any white folks at all. So, again, what they're alleging is just simply not true. And if it has to, and as ludicrous as this may sound, Jenna, this modern day movement of critical race theory would literally have you believe that slavery was still in existence back in the 1990s, which is simply not true.
Well, I mean, you know, these are the same people that just want to reinvent and reimagine history. They want to rewrite history. They want to take the provisions of the Constitution out of context, out of the context with which they were ratified and the plain language. I mean, you know, these are people who just want to advance their agenda in any way possible. And of course, they're going to advance this absurd rhetoric that doesn't pair with reality, just to be fearmongers and frankly, just totally divisive. And so, you know, it's incumbent, I think, on the church especially to take advantage of this moment of maybe a return to common sense and actually promote more good, not just, you know, fight against all of the forces of evil, but actually go out and promote good and explain why, from a biblical worldview, the policy that President Trump is implementing, even Elon, who doesn't claim to be a Christian at all, but the policy that they are promoting is actually truthful and it mirrors reality. And so you mentioned, you know, that people should be calling their members of Congress and the state legislature and all of that. How should Christians, in your view, be getting even more involved in civil government and civil society?
Well, I think this goes back to where we started our conversation, where the most important positions, I believe, in our elected government happen to be on the school board. And I think there should be a call to action for Christians, especially, to consider running for the local school boards, getting involved on the local level. And that's ultimately where it's all going back to, right? I mean, the whole point of Roe v. Wade was abortion is a state decision. Well, we need to make sure that we have rock solid pro-lifers that we're electing to the state houses across the country. But again, even more so locally, city council, mayor, we need a new generation of Christians that are willing to rise up and say, you know what? I am willing to do that, and I understand how important that position is. And sadly, in many, many conservative towns across the nation, I'll give you an example. I live in Germantown, Tennessee, which is a very conservative suburb of Memphis, and yet we have a very liberal school board. And it's, again, the reason why is because local folks just aren't willing to sacrifice their time, the energy it's needed to run for an office like that. So that would be my encouragement to folks.
I agree with that. And definitely we all need to be contributing in some way to civil society and making sure that our voices are heard. And also not just to elect rock solid pro-lifers in their, you know, personal capacity or maybe name only, but people who will actually take that position and will effectively govern and shape policy according to that worldview. Because one of the biggest disappointments has been these people who say, yeah, I'm a pro-lifer, or, you know, I stand for conservative principles in various areas, and then they get to their elected office and they don't actually champion those beliefs in the very seat that they have the opportunity to shape policy. And so we need to make sure that we connect those dots. So Todd Starnes, always really appreciate your time. You can follow him at Todd Starnes on X and read all of the latest headlines at toddstarnes.com. We'll be right back with more here on President's Day on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. If we have learned anything from the 2024 election, it's how important it is for us to fight, fight, fight. We also learned how desperately the left wants to fight to take babies' lives, which is why every day Preborn Ministries fights for the babies. Preborn's network of clinics are positioned in the highest abortion areas, fighting for mothers deciding between the life and death of their child. Preborn welcomes these women with God's love and offers them a free ultrasound to introduce their precious baby and hear the beautiful heartbeat. This amazing encounter gives her baby a fighting chance, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. So would you join Preborn in the fight for life? One ultrasound is just $28, and $140 will sponsor 5 ultrasounds. Babies are worth fighting for. To donate, dial #250 on your cell phone and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or you can visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible and Preborn has a 4-star charity rating. Fight, fight, fight for the babies.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, the left is kind of going through even more of a hysterical breakdown over the mass resignation. This coming from the Washington Post, mass resignation marks a new kind of defiance in the second Trump era. The Trump team has rarely, if ever, faced such resistance from the government, a move that may pave the way for further defiance. And NBC News headline is this, under the tagline DOGE, Trump administration begins mass firings across government. The job cuts are being imposed unilaterally without the approval of Congress to shrink or overhaul federal agencies. And so this piece goes on to say that the terminations affected some of the most widely respected federal agencies. You know, of course, this is from Legacy Media. I'm not sure any of us would say that any federal offices are widely respected anymore, but they include, according to NBC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and Homeland Security, as well as lower profile offices with critical roles in the nation's security, such as the National Nuclear Security Administration, the NNSA. The agency designs, builds, and oversees the U.S. nuclear weapons stockpile. So let's welcome in Gerard Folletti, who is the founder of the Lawfare Project and senior counsel there. And Gerard, you know, I'm all for downsizing government. This whole idea of, you know, mass resignations that are in defiance of Trump, I'm thinking, okay, continue to defy him then. And, you know, good riddance, you're going to actually have to go out into the real world that is outside of the Beltway.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I think that when you see these mass resignations, they are people who would be obstructing Trump's administration, Trump's policies, his priorities and his agenda. And if they can't serve the president of the United States in the capacity that they need to, then they shouldn't be in government. This really shouldn't be that political. You're implementing the will ultimately of the American people as expressed through the person that they voted into office. And if you can't do that, if you're putting your own interests above those of the American people, then leave. We don't want you in Washington.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so funny. I saw a post on X from a reporter, and I forget exactly what news outlet, but was showing a map of all of the property in the D.C. area that had been put on the market in the last like 14 days. And the caption on it was, you know, the rats are abandoning ship. And I'm thinking, this is great. Like, you know, put up the property, disperse, and maybe the D.C. bureaucracy will be a lot less cumbersome. You know, but the response to that from the left when they're not having their hysterical meltdowns is, you know, this kind of continuity in government theme and saying, well, you know, not every worker is political and not every job, you know, is something that turns on whether there's a Republican or Democrat in office. And we need to have some of these federal workers so that we actually know what we're doing in government. What's your response to kind of that continuity sort of theory?
I do think that that is a good argument, but we also need to look at how many people we need to be doing that. We do know that there is bloat in some of these departments. We do know that far more people have been hired over the years who don't really seem to understand what their jobs are, and quite frankly, the taxpayers don't understand what their jobs are. So yes, we have personnel who we need in government to be doing their jobs and have that continuity from administration to administration of the nitty-gritty of how things are done. But that doesn't make them immune from outsiders like Elon Musk coming in with Doge and examining whether their positions are actually necessary. Just like with any company, you may have people who are important to maintaining the operation of the company, but there may be overstaffed, there may be inefficiencies, and these are things that we need to address, especially when we're running a deficit, especially when the government is not meant to be a jobs program. We want people to serve and then to go into the private sector or go home.
Yeah, so well said, Jared Folletti, that government isn't meant to be a jobs program. Absolutely. And when you're talking about inefficiencies in government, I mean, there are so many things that are so antiquated in government. Like there have been, you know, posts on social media about just some of these very ancient sort of filing systems where federal workers are literally riding like, you know, old time mail carrier tricycles around, like looking for files. And I'm thinking, okay, this is 2025. Like, you guys can get an email address, like you can do online repositories. We definitely have the technology to keep some of that stuff secure. And of course the pushback is, well, you know, AI and some of these tech things would eliminate some of these personnel positions. And I'm thinking that's actually okay if we're talking about spending taxpayer dollars in an efficient manner. And the Secretary of Transportation, now thankfully that is not Pete Buttigieg, but Sean Duffy, posted this in terms of air travel and ensuring that we actually update some of the FAA tech. And he posted this late yesterday. America deserves safe, state-of-the-art air travel, and President Trump has ordered that I deliver a new world-class air traffic control system that will be the envy of the world. To do that, I need advice from the brightest minds in America. I'm asking for help from any high-tech American developer or company that is willing to give back to our country. He talks about Elon Musk's SpaceX team will be visiting air traffic control today and that command center in Virginia. He said, later in the week, I'll travel to the FAA Academy in Oklahoma to meet with air traffic control instructors and students to learn more about their education and how we can ensure that only the very best guide our aircraft. This is something that should have happened, you know, I mean, it seems like maybe right after Y2K. I mean, this is something that, again, in 2025, we shouldn't have such antiquated systems that almost looks like, you know, an old-fashioned Pong board, you know, back and forth that's controlling our air traffic.
But you're absolutely right. And we've heard, I don't want to say that the blame entirely is on wokeness. I mean, wokeness, we've had this problem since before that term came to existence. But when we have a government who one of their priorities is to get agencies to do studies on sustainability, environmental impact, gender equality, and all the things that we don't really need when we need technology. We need the best and the brightest to come up with better ways of doing things for our people. But instead, government agencies have dedicated any resources at all to things beyond that. Not only is it baffling, but it's troubling. And I think that's what's caused a lot of these issues, that we have had government departments run not just inefficiently, but misdirected. Why are we focusing on things outside the purview of the professional scope of these departments? When we want air traffic control systems, we want the technology. We don't want gender-neutral people to be running them. And I think that's what we're getting now. We're getting an emphasis back on what these departments are for. We need the best and the brightest in Washington, D.C. We don't need to qualify their genders and their ethnicity.
Yeah, really well said. And Gerard Folletti, who is the founder of the Lawfare Project, and you know, you and I have had this conversation kind of ongoing, but I think it's important to underscore this point that even if, you know, DEI as a whole is not directly responsible for every single position in terms of the identity of the individual in that capacity, the overall policies are still responsible for funneling so much of the taxpayers' money to things like the woke ideology and promoting all of this leftism instead of spending the dollars on things like good programs, like, you know, an email address that you can actually send things to your government in 2025. You know, some of these things that would actually benefit the American people who are supposed to be the consumers of government and the constituency of government, instead of misdirecting, in my view, so much of these funds elsewhere. And so, you know, we're seeing a lot of this that's being streamlined. And that's really, I think, why the left is yelling so much about this, is not even so much, you know, that they're saying, oh, well, you know, so many of the jobs are going to be unavailable now to federal workers. And, you know, they're kind of claiming that, but their real underlying problem with it is that the ideology and the mentality and the dollars available to spend on these programs will no longer be available.
No, that's true. And it's also, I think, it's shaking the foundation of what we understand as being the deep state. And by deep state, I don't mean something suspicious or pernicious or people doing something shady, although some do. It's this idea that the government is so entrenched, that some people in administrative agencies have become so entrenched that they are a law unto themselves. And the way it works in government is the way it works in a lot of the third world and even, unfortunately, private companies in America. You have individuals who start to hire people like them, who think like them, who believe like them, who have the same priorities. So over the course of decades, you've got government bureaucracies, government agencies that have shifted to a group of like-minded people who may very well be deaf to the needs of the American people or the will of the people they serve, the elected officials. And that's really what the issue is. They're being shaken out of office. They're losing these positions. They're losing their power to do what they want. And they're being replaced, to the extent that they are, by normal people who are there for to do a job, not to implement their own agendas.
And so when we're looking at all of this and we're seeing a lot of the legal challenges already that are being brought by the left and, you know, on behalf basically of the deep state and the administrative state and the big bureaucracy, do they have any chance of success other than reliance on these activist judges that are really just legislating their own policy from the bench instead of merely being jurists?
At the end of the day, if the administration, if the Trump administration wants to fire them, they will be fired. The issue really is whether the proper procedures are being followed and whether you're dotting the I's and crossing the T's. Now, I can't really speak to all of these cases because I, quite frankly, don't know that everything that Trump has done in each department, whether, you know, what procedures were used. But generally speaking, from what I understand, procedures have been followed. He's terminated employees that don't have civil service protection, like probationary employees, for example. That's really not subject to court scrutiny. Other things that he has done with layoffs have been approved by the court, who did not suspend some of these practices. So really, I think Trump can do it. Legal challenges will ultimately fail or be made moot by the fact that, you know, if procedure is followed, he can certainly fire them. This is precedent going back decades that the president can do this. Bill Clinton did this. So at the end of the day, the courts will rule in his favor, but it just might take a little while to get there.
And that's exactly what the left is counting on, is just to try to run out this 4-year clock. And, you know, Trump said in, I think it was in a press conference sometime, a week or two ago, it feels like we've already lived like, 300 news cycles in the last 3 weeks. But he said that, that ultimately, 4 years seems like a really long time, but in Washington, it's really not that long. And so the left, it appears that they are trying to just forestall any of this action for as long as they possibly can, to then just try to run out the clock. And that brings us to a conversation of these whole nationwide injunctions. And I think it's utterly preposterous and ridiculous that judges on any scale can do this from a district court level and can impose a nationwide injunction from their own bench. There's been a lot of talk, not just during the Trump administration or even the first one, about the impropriety judicially of nationwide injunctions. What's your view?
Well, I also think it's important to remember it cuts both ways. When you have a Democrat in office and you're filing lawsuits to prevent or to forestall some of that agenda, you go to certain districts, especially in Texas, and you find conservative judges willing to do the same thing. I think ultimately what would benefit is having a more specialized court or identifying a court to handle these types of cases that have, where you're bringing a nationwide request for a nationwide injunction, or cases that have this national application. When you leave it to separate courts, yes, of course, eventually you end up before the U.S. Supreme Court, but that still takes time, and that still serves the purpose of dragging out and forestalling things from being implemented. So maybe the answer here is a reform of the judiciary, where you have a specialized court that is empowered to hear these cases with expedited review by the U.S. Supreme Court.
And, that's just another measure of efficiency. And wouldn't that be great if we actually had some efficiency in the judiciary as well? But it almost seems like, to a certain extent, because they're one of the non-political branches, they're a little bit untouchable in some of those ways. But, Congress could do that by a Judiciary Act. I mean, they are allowed to create, under Article 3 of the Constitution, those types of inferior courts. And, if we actually are talking about efficiency and streamlining, this goes back to Congress and really is a matter of political will and courage. And it's been interesting to see how much focus has been on Trump and the executive and DOGE and all of these things. But Congress here really needs to act in a wide variety of areas. We do have a very slim conservative / Republican air quotes majority. Where do you think we're at on the scale of political will for some of these more enduring wins?
Well, I think that's why we are seeing so much emphasis on President Trump and his initiatives. It's because I don't think we have the political will yet to take some of the hard actions or pass some of the legislation that will really advance these goals on a more permanent basis. I think that you have to pick and choose your battles. And Trump has yet to put initiatives before Congress that he prioritizes. So really, it's a waiting game. We have to see which agenda items Trump really wants Congress to pass. He does have the political capital to get some of them done, but it will be interesting to see which ones. A lot of people are thinking it will have to do with border and security issues first and foremost. We've already seen passage of the Laken Riley Act, and that being signed into law, that was the first thing Donald Trump signed into law. So we do see a will of Congress, of Republicans in Congress, however we define them, to do some things, but I don't think that we have the numbers or the fortitude to put into play a lot of Trump's agenda items. We need more people in Congress. We need a better, we need better electives, and we will see that, I think, in 2 years. I'm one of the people who thinks Republicans will win more seats, not fewer. So I'm optimistic that 2 years from now, we will have a better Congress to put forward a lot of these agenda items.
I hope so. I hope that that is an accurate prediction. Gerard Folletti, really appreciate your time and commentary as always. You can follow him on X at Gerard Folletti, and also go to thelawfareproject.org. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back. back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, speaking of getting rid of the big bureaucracy, the bloat, draining the swamp, all of that, there was a really good thread on X that you need to read in detail that I also reposted. And it's from Tyler O'Neill, who's the managing editor at the Daily Signal. He's also the author of The Woketopus. And you need to definitely read that book. But it's titled this thread, The Left's Tentacles in USAID. USAID wasn't just spending your tax dollars to promote woke causes overseas. It also ties into the left's dark money and influence network that called the shots in the Biden administration. He goes on to describe what is USAID, the Soros connection, the Trump impeachment, Open Society funding, the Tides Foundation, the revolving door, and more on that research and his work. He also links to a piece from the Daily Signal. And Tyler joins me now. So, Tyler, this is really, really good in-depth reporting. So what were some of just the highlights in terms of the major discoveries on this thread that you've reported?
Yeah, thanks, Jenna. I think one of the big things that really stood out to me was all of the revolving door aspects of it. There was, you know, one after another, you find these staffers. And, you know, one of the things that really, you know, I've been looking into USAID ever since, you know, Trump froze foreign funding and DOGE launched its, you know, essential takeover. You had Trump putting Rubio in charge of USAID. And it's just been one thing after another, so much corruption in this one agency. And I think this agency is a great, you know, exhibit A of what DOGE cleaning out the federal government really looks like. But some of the things that really struck me were that former USAID staffers, and many of these people, you know, spent a long period of time at USAID, people like Ann Van Dusen, who spent 25 years there. Now she's a senior associate at Arabella Advisors, which is the for-profit company that launched a bunch of nonprofits that are, it's a very shadowy for part of the left's dark money network that is funding all the woke activist groups that really called the shots in the Biden administration. But, you know, you also saw people who worked at USAID going on to work for the Center for American Progress. You saw one of the interesting people was a guy who went from USAID to the Human Rights Campaign and then back to USAID. And USAID was so proud of this guy that they, you know, they trumpeted him and said he was an LGBTQI plus coordinator. So the entire, you know, the entire reason for his job is to push gender ideology and all of the, you know, the woke LGBT revolution.
Wow. This is just incredible. And, you know, we've at least suspected on the conservative side that a lot of this was going on for a while, but actually having DOGE provide the receipts and some of this transparency is just proving and evidencing what we all thought was going on for a while. And we just talked in the last segment, Tyler, about, you know, these headlines of mass resignations and then also some of the mass layoffs from the Trump administration. Did you uncover anything that was, you know, kind of connecting these dots in terms of saying, okay, here's where DOGE is seeing that a lot of the USAID money and other was spent on, you know, some of these programs and sort of targeting maybe some of those employees that really, in all honesty, just don't deserve a federal government job?
Yeah, I haven't been able to connect specifically those that have, you know, left recently with these situations. But one of the really surprising things to me was the funding through the Tides Foundation, which is another one of the big dark money funding outfits that I cover in the book. And, you know, Tides is the one that has their own in-house nonprofit that is giving legal representation to anti-Israel rioters on college campuses. They call it Palestine Legal, and they've bragged that they've represented or advised hundreds of students since the October 7th massacre. But we've seen Tides fund groups like the Center for American Progress, the Natural Resources Defense Fund and the Sierra Club, the Southern Poverty Law Center and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. and the ACLU, all of these activist groups had large impacts in the Biden administration, as I talk about in the Woke to Puss. But it's also, you know, it's just these groups also, they fund, so USAID sends money to countries overseas promoting woke causes. Many of the same recipients are the ones that are bankrolled by these left-wing foundations, especially, you know, you saw it through the Open Society Foundations, which was founded by George Soros, now run by Alex Soros. And they're one of the big people calling the shots, too. If there's any leftist cause you know about, I'm pretty sure George Soros has put money behind it.
Wow. And yeah, thankfully, we have maybe our own similar but definitely more based George Soros now at least funding some of these good initiatives in Elon Musk. And, you know, but his view is entirely opposite in so many ways from a Soros. Instead of wanting to get power for himself, he wants more transparency and openness and efficiency and all of these things for the American people. And that's exactly the type of billionaire that you want helping the current administration. But Tyler O'Neill, my guest this morning, who's the author of The Woke to Puss, The Dark Money Cabal Manipulating the Federal Government. You can get that on Amazon or wherever books are sold. You also mentioned the Human Rights Campaign and a lot of these things that we were seeing over the last several years with the push from giant corporations that were really antithetical to their own bottom line and their own consumer base was based on this Human Rights Campaign scoring system. And for a long time, I've kind of wondered, you know, why does that even matter to these corporations? Like, why do they care that they have a good Human Rights Campaign score? Like, what is the benefit? Is there a correlation at all that we've seen from, you know, some of this funding and the money and the Human Rights Campaign involvement to maybe some of these things that we've seen, like, you know, Bud Light going woke or, you know, some of these other organizations that are for-profit entities that aren't part of the federal government, but they're kind of acting like they're beholden to the Soros Human Rights Campaign elements?
Yes. Well, the Human Rights Campaign had been, so the Soros elements are usually kind of in the background. And I really appreciate your contrast there with Elon and Soros. I think they represent diametrically opposed worldviews about how money and government should function. You know, Soros has this very technocratic, like, oh, I'm going to make it so that my preferred causes are supported by the government. Whereas Elon is like, no, we want creative destruction, and I'm going to root out the corruption in the government. And, you know, these are night and day alternatives. But the Human Rights Campaign really has all this impact because of the ESG movement, environmental social governance. You had a lot of these venture capitalists, and I think what we're starting to see is venture capitalists are moving away from this model now. Not all of them, unfortunately, but many have seen the light and rejected it. So there are reasons why the Human Rights Campaign got its impact, because venture capitalists were saying, we want to judge by ESG, and we only want to invest in companies that have good social scores. And they used the Human Rights Campaign as a major arbiter of social scores. But the Human Rights Campaign has thankfully lost a lot of its impact, partially because, as you mentioned, Bud Light and Target in 2023 essentially destroyed their own consumer bases by leaning too heavily into the Human Rights Campaign. And, you know, the Human Rights Campaign was not happy when they started to back away a little bit from HRC. But at the same time, you know, they know that their bottom line doesn't come from the Human Rights Campaign. And the 2023 aspects really started moving corporate America away from ESG. And last year you saw, even before Trump won, you saw a lot of companies pulling out of the corporate equality index, not necessarily because they had seen the light, but because they know that their consumer bases are more conservative, and so they naturally didn't want to alienate them. Now with Trump in office, he's going after that movement whole hog and saying, look, civil rights law means that you can't discriminate against people by their skin color. What an idea. But he's applying it in a way that hadn't been applied before. And so DEI and ESG are losing steam. As we speak, even Target has pulled out of the Human Rights Campaign's Corporate Equality Index. We're going to have to see if this is a longstanding movement. I think, you know, I tend to be a little bit cynical. I think that many of the woke companies didn't actually fully go woke. They just thought it was in their interest to do so at the time. And so when they're rejecting it, they aren't necessarily becoming based, but they are seeing where the wind is blowing. But we'll have to see. I hope that we can get back to a time when companies are not bowing and scraping for leftist causes and actually focusing on making goods and services for the American people.
Yeah, and that was going to be my next question that you kind of answered already, Tyler, is whether this is going to be actually longstanding or if these companies, you know, almost similar to Meta and Mark Zuckerberg. It's like he's all against censorship now and, you know, Trump's BFF and wanting to, you know, kind of go where the White House is going with this. But if Kamala Harris were in the White House, thankfully she's not, I don't think we would see that kind of commitment from Zuckerberg. And so it does beg the question of whether this is more of an enduring win or whether this is just a temporary rollback. What needs to be done maybe beyond what Trump is doing in the executive to ensure that this is more of a lasting change, not just a temporary sort of 4-year reprieve?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. On these issues, it's very hard to see how we could prevent a future Democratic administration from trying to do the same thing that Biden did. I think maybe if Congress passed a law that says, you know, we don't view, you know, essentially codifying what Trump has done on DEI, saying, look, this is racial discrimination and federal civil rights law prevents it. I think, you know, the plain reading of the text favors Trump's view, but the way that, you know, what we've seen with some of these lawless Democratic administrations is completely ignoring the basic fact and pushing their ideology anyway. I mean, the main example of that has been the way that Biden weaponized Bostock. And of course, I don't think Bostock was a good Supreme Court decision in the first place. That's the one that said that you can't fire someone for their sexual orientation or gender identity, which of course is, and of course they redefined the word sex in the law to try to force this on people. And it's interesting that Supreme Court ruling, specifically Justice Gorsuch, who wrote the majority opinion, said this does not apply to bathrooms, it does not apply to anything besides employment law. But what did Biden do on essentially his first day in office? Oh, yeah, he applied it to all the places that Gorsuch said it didn't apply to. So if you give them an inch on these ideological issues, they will take a mile. And, you know, that's why, you know, Trump is doing an excellent job in office right now. But the way, you know, the way to prevent them from weaponizing and changing things again is really to stay vigilant and to remember that, you know, when you're voting, you're not just voting the top of the ticket. You're also voting for the people who are going to come in any administration. There's going to be a lot of people nominated to specific roles. And if you want a bunch more of Alejandro Mayorkas's or, you know, Rachel Levine's, then I think one party is more representative of that view. And if you want more sanity and cutting of federal bloat, that's where we are right now. So hopefully the American people will be paying attention to that. But yeah, I mean, I think you can't ever rest on your laurels in politics. You can't ever expect that one victory is the last word.
Yeah, that's such a great point. And it just underscores, Tyler O'Neill, that we have so much work to do still. And 4 years, as President Trump said, is really not that long. And hopefully in the next 2 years, with the midterms, we'll see even more conservatives that are elected that will get behind a lot of this agenda and will continue to build the momentum and evidence why the conservative policies work on behalf of America and truly making America great, and to continue to rid America of a lot of these woke policies. So just quickly, where can people find The Woketopus, and why should they read it?
Yeah, well, thank you. You can find it on Amazon. There is an ebook version, a paperback version, a hardcover version. In about a month or so, we're going to have the audiobook version, which I'm really excited about.
Amazing.
But yeah, you should read it because it is a roadmap to understanding the infrastructure of the left, the longstanding threat that the Trump administration is facing right now, and you know what, how they were able to pull the wool over the eyes of the American people in the last 4 years.
All right, well, get it on Amazon or wherever books are sold. And Tyler, thanks so much. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net, and have a great President's Day.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.